you. My name is Rusty Kelly. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I'm in Al-Anon. By the grace of God and the fellowship of this company, I have not found it necessary to rescue an alcoholic since the 25th of March, 1966. I belong to the Lost and Found Al-Anon group in Lafayette, Colorado, and contrary to any rumor you may have heard to the contrary, that is the greatest Al-Anon group in the United States. I came here a little differently than most Al-Anons come today because many of the people that we see new in our program are the adult children of alcoholics. I came here as the adult of a child alcoholic. But I came sort of backwards. I was a breech birth, and I've been sort of backing into things ever since. And I came in rather backward. I came from a family where everyone drank, and to the best of my knowledge, there was no alcoholism. I tell you that, and I believe it's true, although it also seems possible to me that God will yet reveal to me things that he has not yet revealed, since out of the three children who grew up in that family, we have two in Al-Anon and one in AA. But as far as I know, I grew up in a family where alcohol was a common commodity. It was served with meals. It was used but not abused. And I grew up thinking of alcoholics sort of the way I thought about Democrats. I knew there were a lot of them, but I never expected to know any personally. I came from that household, which was a fairly stable household. It was dysfunctional in some ways, and if you come from a family that's not dysfunctional in any way, I'd like to meet you after the meeting, because I've never met one before, and I'd like to shake your hand. I'd like to have you tell me how you've convinced yourself of that, too. In that family, we went to church, and I heard about God, and I was not impressed. I mean, you know, I'm a little older than some of you, but in my day in church, the preacher preached a wonderful sermon against women wearing slacks, and he showed up in a skirt. They kept God in a little box on the altar, and they let him out to tell us when we came, to tell us what he was mad about, and he was always mad about something, and he was very incompetent. I mean, he couldn't keep the furnace going. I was an Army brat, and I lived in almost every state in the Union before I was 18. And in none of those states could he ever keep the furnace going. They always had to take up another collection to fix the furnace. Now, my father was no great shakes, but he could fix furnaces. And he could stay within the household budget, and God never could. They always had to have a special collection because he'd overrun the budget. And I was not impressed with him. I thought my dad was pretty good. He managed everything, and he managed it rather well. And I was much more impressed with him than I was with God. And I decided that if there was a God, he had nothing to do with me, and he sort of kept Venus from bumping into Mars and the moon from falling on our heads. And that was his sphere, and I could get along without him in mine. I grew up and met a man who came from a dreadful household, a truly dreadful household. People in that household drank. They drank, and they not only saw little animals that were not visible to me, occasionally they shot one of them. So I knew that this man needed to be saved, needed to be rescued, needed me to help him get out of that terrible household and the dreadful things that happened in it. And I knew that he, when I married him and he moved into my well-ordered, beautifully run household, he would be so grateful for that, out of that dreadful place, that he would never, never give me any trouble. I did marry him as quickly as I could, but he somehow didn't see my family life as greatly superior to what he had in mind for himself, and he was hard to convert to my way of thinking. We got married, and we assessed what we had in common. It was that we were married in the same church on the same day. And we began a game of hide and hide. Now, maybe you know how to play hide and seek, but that's not what we were playing. We were playing hide and hide. Nobody was seeking. We were both hiding. We did this a little differently. He hid in some bad places that society does not approve of very much, and I hid in wonderful places where I got a lot of support from society, and they applauded me. I mean, I'm a little wife, and I'm a little mother, and I'm going to school, and I'm hiding in school as effectively as he's hiding in his hiding places. I'm not speaking against school, I'm speaking against hiding, and I was hiding as efficiently as he was. But you see, they applauded about my hiding places and not about his. One of the things I had wanted to do as a little girl growing up was to have a big family, and in that I succeeded. And at one point, I had 6 little boys, and the oldest was not yet 8. And hey, you do it in groups, it's not as hard as you think. I didn't have a lot of time for introspection and asking myself, am I happy and is life content? I was sort of busy. Sometimes for days, the only place I ever was between the stove and the washing machine, occasionally breaking up a little fight among the boys. I knew my children were not going to fight. I didn't understand how it happened to me that I made 6 trips to the hospital to have a baby, and they gave me the wrong kid every time. I mean, I wanted the little darlings like you get on Hallmark cards. Well, they didn't give me those. They gave me kids that occasionally, often smelled bad and yelled loud, and that was not part of my plan, and they were not fulfilling me. And you know, my dad said I could grow up and be president of the country or president of General Motors if I wanted to. But the offstage chorus of my mother and my aunts and my grandmothers was all saying, yes, but it won't count if you don't get married and have children. You can't be fulfilled without that. And that's a terrible trip to put on a couple of poor little kids. Here they haven't even been born yet. They're hardly born, and they've already failed at something. They were supposed to fulfill me, and they have failed at that. So my relationship with them was not a whole lot better than it was with their father. We decided we would move. My husband was retiring from the service on a medical retirement, and so we decided we'd get away from the in-laws, who were really wrecking our marriage. I mean, there wasn't anything wrong with it that getting away from the in-laws wouldn't fix. So we moved to a town in New Mexico. I don't know if you have them in Nebraska, but in New Mexico, they have a whole lot of little towns. The whole town fits in between yield ahead and resume speed. We moved into one of those towns and bought the newspaper, which is not the Royal Road to Riches. And you understand that I was not in charge of things, and I was not bossy and pushy, but his degree was in electrical engineering and mine was in journalism. So of course, we bought a newspaper. What did you want? An electronic store? Don't be silly. In New Mexico, the twins, my second delivery in the hospital had resulted in twins. And in that town, the twins began to drink. Now, I know that sounds terrible to outside people, but you know, in a family that's already a mess, a drunk is not a bad thing to have. Because you see, now you have a designated sicko, and you don't have to be it. If you're in your pre-Al-Anon stage, it's nice to have a designated sicko. And you can have family councils where you talk about how to help the designated sicko. You can have family quarrels where you quarrel about how to help the designated sicko. And you never have to go and look in a mirror and say, is it possible that person is sick? Because you've got a sick. And you just look at him and say, see, that's the one who's sick. And it takes all the attention off yourself, takes it off the floundering marriage, and puts it on an alcoholic. And I think they secretly enjoy it. I really do. I've been told that they don't, but I think they secretly just get off on it. They love being the center of attention like that, and they love frustrating all that attempts to help them. You know, I devised a plan to help them. I understood that my husband and his family didn't know anything about alcohol. They just drank and got drunk and shot non-existent animals and had terrible fights and chased each other throughout the house and threw up a lot. And so I understood that they didn't know anything about alcohol. And so I could see that what was wrong with the children was just a lack of education. And I set about educating them. I knew what to drink with what and how much. So I began to teach them. I taught them, the wine seemed like a good thing to start on. It didn't seem like it was very alcoholic. So I thought I'd start them out on wine to teach them. And I taught them that you drank white wine with fish. And they learned that, and they drank white wine with fish, and they drank it without fish. And so I thought, since they were still teenagers and didn't have very much money, the next good idea would be to teach them to drink very expensive drinks. So I started them out on Courvoisier and very expensive brandy. And I taught them to light a little candle under the glass to keep it the right temperature and to hold it in their hands and to inhale the smell through their noses and their mouths and to learn to enjoy it. And did you ever see a drunk taking an hour and a half to drink an ounce and a half and inhaling it through his nose and his mouth and turning the glass to keep it the right temperature? They just won't learn that. The newspaper predictably went broke, in spite of the fact that I wrote it, he printed it, the kids sold it on the street corners, and it went broke anyway. And so we moved up to Denver, the big city, where we were going to have wonderful opportunities. And in the big city, I devised my best plan for curing their alcoholism. I decided that they would bring home satisfactory report cards, or they would go into the Navy. Well, at that time, the Navy had a thing called the kiddie cruise that you could join at 17 and get out at 21, and I very soon had a couple of kiddies cruising. One of them actually finished his enlistment, and one of them, I got a letter from a politician. Well, actually, the first letter was from the Navy. It said, "We're sending him home. He drinks too much." They said, I thought, you know, this kid is too drunk to be a drunken sailor, and that's got to be god-awful drunk. And the rest of the letter said they didn't really mind him drinking, but his behavior under the influence was unacceptable. I knew that before I sent him out. They don't need to send me a letter about that. He sent me a letter, too. It said he didn't want to get out of the service. He wanted to make it his career. And he wanted desperately to stay in the service. So I wrote to my congressman, and probably I wrote to your congressman. I wrote to all the ones I'd heard about, and asked them to keep him in the service just as a special favor to me. And they were not impressed with that request, and they wrote back and said they didn't think they could do that, but please vote for him anyway. So I did what any sensible, good-thinking American mother would do. I called the President of the United States. You laugh because you think you can't do that. The White House has a listed number, and you can certainly call the White House. And I did. But do you know what they have at the White House? They have a switchboard. Who would expect in a private residence that they would have a switchboard? I thought maybe I'd get Lady Bird and she'd say, "Well, honey, Lyndon's walking the dog, but as soon as he comes back, I'll have him take care of it for you." They have this woman on the switchboard, and I tell you, that woman is cold. And you do not get past her. And I didn't get past her in three tries. So I was pretty desperate. He was coming home. I didn't know what to do, so I made a deal with God. Now, I know I told you that I really believe in God, and certainly I didn't think God had anything to do with me personally. But, you know, this is an Al-Anon story. It's not a sensible story. So I made the deal with God that if he would let Bernie die overseas and be a hero, I would never tell anyone, especially his brothers, that he was a drunk and was a disgrace and was a shame to the family. I would only tell them that he was a great hero who gave his life for his country. Bernie said since he never had any intention of doing that. If they wanted his life, they're going to have to take it away from him. He wasn't given. But that was my deal with God and my prayer. And God heard my prayer and he answered it. He said no. And Bernie came home. Well, I was pretty desperate. He was due home in a few days, and there was a little ad in the Aurora paper. Aurora is a suburb of Denver. And it said, is there a drinking problem? Do you have a drinking problem? If so, call this number. So I called the number and said, I have a drinking problem. He's due home Tuesday. Would you kindly come and get it? And the man who answered that phone call said he was an alcoholic, gave his name and said he was an alcoholic, and he didn't even have enough sense to be ashamed of it. He just said it in a perfectly normal voice, the way he would say, hi, my name's Tom and I have blue eyes. He was not upset about that fact, so I knew I was getting into a pretty weird group. And I explained that Bernie was coming home and that they should come and get him. I'd read someplace that a new drunk, a new member of Al-Anon AA was like a new baby and he couldn't be left alone. So I figured I worked 3 to 11, my husband worked 8 to 5, and we just needed somebody from AA for the off shift so we could get some sleep. And I explained that to the man who kept saying, like it was a ritual, he kept saying, we don't do that. Well, the president didn't do what I asked, and AA's not going to do what I ask, and it's pretty desperate. And he said, did Bernie ask you to call? And I explained that Bernie is a very wily little drunk, and you can't just walk up and catch him. We have to arrange a plan so you guys can get him. And he said again, we don't do that. And then he said something that was absolutely astonishing. He said to me, now I am holding this family together. I have a responsible job. I am a perfectly wonderful individual. And he said to me, maybe you're sick. I mean, the nerve of this man, he doesn't even know. But I did think about it, and I thought of the conversation over in my mind quickly, and I decided that he thought that I was the alcoholic. And my conversation did sound a trifle odd. And he said, I'll have my wife call you. And then I knew that he thought I was the alcoholic. And certainly he was not coming out to my house, since he was a man and I'm a woman, to search me for the bottle. He wanted his wife to come out and frisk me and find the bottle. And I was a little taken aback by that, but it made sense. And I sort of had this picture in my mind, the big white station wagon outside that said, Alcoholics Anonymous, search and destroy. So I didn't talk to him anymore, but his wife called me. When she called me, I've no idea why I talked to her as I did. I've no idea then, now I know. But I did. For the first time in my life, I admitted to someone that life was not perfect in my household. You know, at work, I told them we had problems, sort of the kind they had on I Love Lucy and Leave It to Beaver and things like that. But I never said what was really wrong. I never said that there was really pain, that there was really destruction going on in that family, and I told her. Now, I have no idea what she did. I think she put the phone down and went on about her business and came back every once in a while and said, uh-huh. But I felt very guilty because I was brought up in a family where you don't share that kind of thing We do not burden others with our problems and our pain. And I was horrified to think that I'd let her in on the secret of my family and what was going on in it. So when she said I should, excuse me, I should go to a meeting, I felt very obligated. I'd taken up her time and I had to repay it, and I thought that probably they gave an award, maybe a silver teapot to the person who brought in the most members, and I owed it to her to go. And so I went. Now this was the 60s. Remember the 60s? There were two kinds of people. Hippies with long unwashed hair and the ladies who were in that room with blue beehives screwed to the top of their head. Their hair was absolutely indestructible. They could have gone through a hurricane without mussing a bit of it. And I looked at that room. We had home meetings then, and they were held in homes, and this one was. And I said the famous first words of Al-Anon. Oh my God, have I come to this. But you know, those sweet matrons with their indestructible hair and their lovely home gave me something that I had never received anywhere else in my life. These women that I had prejudged and found wanting took me into that home, and they gave me, for the first time in my life, unconditional love. Now, I had been loved at home. I grew up in a family where love was an understood thing. But I always understood that I was loved, but I would be better loved if I kept my room clean, if I got all A's, if there were all kinds of ifs, if not in their hearts, at least in my head. And there were no ifs there. They didn't say, come in and we'll love you, and we'll love you more as soon as you have finished the steps, or we'll love you more if you are successful in getting the alcoholic sober, or any of the things that I had always heard in every other place. They loved me as I was, and as I was no prize. Bernie came home just in time. I was off work because of an injury to my back. I was off for a long time and I couldn't drive the car. So I got to go to all the AA meetings with him, 90 meetings in 90 days. It was wonderful. I gave him the elbow in the ribs when they said significant things that he needed to hear. I explained to him on the way home in the car all the fine little nuances of the program that he may have missed. But you know, he got sober anyway. And after a time, he got something a little more. There's something different about what he got than sober. Sober is not drunk, not thrown up, not sick, not your head in the white bowl worshiping the water gods. It's something different than that. Sober is a spiritual experience, and he began to have one. There were ways that were different. It wasn't the absence of alcohol. It was the presence of something. And I saw that and wanted it a lot. I remember saying to him, why don't I get what you have? And he said, well, some are sicker than others. And some are just thicker. And so I went to the person. We assigned temporary sponsors for new people in those days, and somebody got the short straw and became my temporary sponsor. And I went to her and explained what it was that I wanted, and she said that I would have to do the steps to get that. And I read through the steps, and I could hardly wait to get back to the next meeting to tell them how wonderful I thought the steps were. I mean, I came bursting into that meeting and said, you should have told me about these earlier. These are wonderful. How do I get him to do them? And when it was explained to me that I was going to have to do them myself, I read them through again a little more slowly and decided which ones I would do. I was not going to do any of the ones that had anything to do with God because I didn't believe in Him, and you said, take what I want and leave the rest. So I was leaving those. And I explained that to my sponsor, and she said that, well, we do like the program to be short and simple and concise. And the only thing I know of that's wrong with what you want to do is that it won't work. And that woman, I think she was a clone of the one on the switchboard. I wanted to do the fourth step and then do the fifth step and have her grant me absolution and get on with my life. And she would not do that. She kept me on the second step. I think half of forever I was on the second step. She would not let me go anywhere else, because she said, you can't do anything else until you have decided that you can be restored to sanity. Well, I had a little trouble with that. It wasn't that I didn't think I could be restored, but I couldn't remember any real protracted periods of sanity in my life. So I wasn't sure about restored, and she said that when I was conceived in the mind of God, I was perfect, and therefore I was sane, and I could go back to that state with some help from God. And since I didn't have a God, it was a little hard for me to get through the second step. My sponsor talked a lot about God, and I came to believe in a God that was quite similar to hers, but wasn't quite hers, and wasn't quite adequate for what I needed, but I didn't know that, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter where you start. And I started with her God, sort of with his hair combed differently and a new pair of shoes and, you know, a few things different than hers, but nothing very much. And I began to trudge the road to happy destiny. I have to tell you, I found the road to happy destiny to be full of potholes. I had been on this program a few years and I was really trying to work it. When I was called at work one night, I still worked that shift, and I was called, told that my daughter, I have one daughter who was born on the twins' 13th birthday. We were going to name her Encore because she wasn't on the original program. When she was 16, she went to the police station and had her father arrested for rape and incest that had been going on in her life since she was 6 years old. I did what you do on this program, because you give rather than get. I went to the police station, I got her out, and I called my sponsor. On both sides of this program, you are wonderful people who come to my rescue whenever I need you, and you didn't say take two aspirin and call back in the morning. You said, can you drive the car or shall we come and get you? And I went to their home and stayed there until, well, you know how AAs are. You know, you're drowning. They will go out there in the worst storm with thunder and lightning all around them to rescue you if you are drowning. They will put the oar in the water and then they will read you the big book before they pull you in. And that is exactly what my sponsor's husband did. And that's what you have always done for me in this program. You love me when I'm too sick to get any better. And then when I'm a little better from your love, and you teach me. And they taught me that in that book, it says that you must pray for the person that you have the resentment against. And I really tried to do that, because I do try to do what sponsors tell me, which is why I'm still alive and here to talk to you. I really tried to do that, and I went home after a day or so and knelt down at my bed and tried it. And I said, God damn him. And I'm sorry if you think that's inappropriate language from here, but I have never said a prayer that I meant any more sincerely than I meant that prayer. But you all came to my house and loved me and helped me until I was able to say that I wanted for him every good gift that I would ask for myself. I divorced him. I can't have him in the house with my daughter. That was obvious to me. We had been divorced only a few years when the lung cancer that had been waiting for him and not been examined became very obvious, and it was very obvious that he was a dying man. And because you taught me, and because you helped me, and because you gave, I was able to take him to California to see his son, bring him back 4 days before his death. I don't know how to do that. I know how to get revenge. I know how to take all the skin off your bones with the sharp side of my tongue. I don't know anything about love and forgiveness except what you have taught me. I came home and we buried him, and I understood that I could never love him the way a man should be loved by his wife, but that I could love him as a fellow child of God and someone suffering from a fatal and horrible illness, and I was able to do that. For a long time after that terrible day in my life, I looked at that and felt that my daughter was a total victim. I still think that's true. But I also thought that I was a perfectly innocent victim. That is not true. You helped me with that. You taught me with that, and I came to see that I worked 3 to 11, not because I had to, but because I wanted to. And although I was very angry with God because I said I let go and let God, and look what happened to my daughter. And it had to be pointed out to me by you people and my sponsor that God had provided a way for my daughter to be protected. It was called mother. And that let go and let God doesn't mean that I can abdicate the responsibilities that are rightfully mine and then be angry with God because he hasn't taken care of the things that it was my job to take care of. And I knew that I had amends to make, and I made them to the best of my ability. My husband had been dead, my ex-husband had been dead less than a year when on one of those bright spring mornings, in fact, the first day of spring that we have in Colorado, my youngest son, straight and sober, put a gun against his temple and fired and died. And I discovered that I had come full cycle in this program. I came in saying, there is no God and he hates me. And this day I was saying, there is a God and I hate him. And I had to go to talk with my sponsor, who said, you will do an inventory on God. The big book says that you do an inventory on institutions, and your God is an institution. And you better do an inventory on the institution that you have such a resentment against. I did that inventory. I didn't find out a whole lot about God, but I found out a whole lot about me. I found out that I'd been a sweet little girl who always got what she wanted from Daddy by manipulating him with smiles. You know, my dad and my grandpa liked little girls that smiled. I was the only kid in the third grade with sunburned gums. And I pulled the same thing on the God I thought I had. I thought if I knelt, I thought if I meditated, I thought if I read the right books, I thought if I did the right gestures, God would somehow look down and maybe look across at St. Peter and say, look at little Rusty Kelly, isn't she special? Don't let anything bad ever happen to her. And I would have successfully manipulated God. So I had to have a new God in a new way and make a new relationship with him. And I found out in that process that it isn't enough for me to have a God who loves me. I have to have a God that I love. And I'd begun working on that almost 2 years to the day that Michael died. His brother, also straight and sober, put a rope around his neck and jumped to his death. I did a little better with that one. I did what you taught me to do in this program. I came home, second thing I did was put my suitcase down. First thing I did was call a sponsor. It's easy to dial a sponsor with a suitcase still in your hand. You can do it. And told her what had happened and said, you and I have got to visit about the third step, because I'm sick of turning my will and my life over to the care of God and having him take my children. And she said, but God doesn't take your children. He receives them. And that is all the difference in the whole world to me, and that is what the program is about. It's about you who live your life in such a way that when people like myself are sliding down the rope and there's no knot, you are in touch with your God so that you can say the words that are necessary. We buried Monk, the boys came home. You know, that was the first year. Those two things happened in the first year of my second son's sobriety. The other twin, Bernie, had been sober for 15 or 16 years at that point. But that was the first year of Chuck's sobriety. You know, and I think that my son didn't die in vain, either of them, because I think somewhere in California, someday one of those boys is going to 12-step someone who thinks he has to drink because his fingernails are broken, and they're going to be able to say, you don't have to drink. This happened in the first year of my sobriety, and I didn't drink, and you don't have to. Now, I don't think that God let my son die so somebody else's child could live. I wouldn't have a God like that. But I believe in a God who's an opportunist. And I believe my son's died as a result of self-will run riot. But I believe that God can use that, the things that happened to them, to help somebody else, and I believe that he will. This is not their story. I guess peripherally, it's the story of two young men for whom I asked God's gift of serenity and who got it in the only way that they would have been willing to accept it. It's also the story of two young men who suffer from a terminal and life-threatening disease and whose disease has been in remission for long periods of time now because of you, because you give and don't ask for anything back because of that. It's also the story of my daughter who today is raising her daughter. If she succeeds in raising that little girl the way she plans to, she will be the first child in five generations in that family to be raised without alcoholism. And I am grateful for that. It's very high on my list of my gratitudes to my higher power. But it's not their story, it's my story, and it's not a story of things that happened long ago. The last of these deaths is 5 years ago. And this is a story about where I am now. Well, of course, now I'm an old-timer in Al-Anon, and I can leap tall alcoholics in a single bound and catch speeding bullets in my teeth. But I have to tell you the truth. I've been on this program more than 21 years, and there are still days that I'm scared. But that's okay, because those days you're still out there. There's still days when the bravest thing I do all day is put on my shoes and walk out the door and go to work. I know that the monsters who have always been out there are still there, but you showed me that they have false teeth and they can't really bite me. I came here a little tiny person frozen in a great big ice cube. And because you loved me, you melted the ice and you let me out of the cube. But that isn't enough because, you see, I believe that the Wicked Witch of the West, or even the Wicked Witch of the alcohol, had put me in that cube and that it wasn't my own choice. And once you got me out of the cube, you made me go visit the Wicked Witch, and I saw that she was me. And you made me do that. And if she is me, then I can give her to God as I give my own life and my own self to God, and she will have no more power because I was in the ice cube since I chose to be. And you have showed me that I don't need the ice cube to keep you from touching me because I'm so afraid of you. I can stay outside of the ice cube. There's a prayer that's attributed to Doug Hammarskjöld, and I'd like to share it with you. I like to close with this particular prayer because it's very meaningful to me. It's very short. And the prayer is, for everything that has been, thank you. For everything that can be, yes. Thank you.